The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I started a topic on looking at working with things in the middle of our lives, how we may find this practice that we cultivate in our sitting helpful in our relationships, at our work, a variety of experiences in our lives. And I just at the end started to touch on how to work with challenging emotions that arise and conflict that arises. And I said I would continue that today some, so I'm doing that. I'll review just a little bit of what I talked about last week in that area, just to set the context. So we all have emotional patterns, emotional habits that we could say we've practiced for our lives. You know, we all, I think, have various familiar tendencies. Some of us may tend towards anger, aversion, that kind of things. Other of us may tend towards confusion or boredom, that kind of thing. But we all have some familiar favorite kinds of habits that we find ourselves in over and over again. And often it can be helpful or interesting to explore these patterns in our lives. These patterns when we're not mindful, when we're not aware of them. They are kind of operating on automatic pilot. They're having us respond and react to things in habitual ways, in ways that we've practiced, in ways that we've gotten very familiar with. It's almost like sometimes we sometimes talk about how people can push our buttons. You know, it's like we have these familiar habits or patterns, and it's that we get in certain situations, and it's like we've got this button installed on our shoulder, and somebody can just come right up and push it. So, you know, this kind of experience where it feels like so and so pushed my button, that can happen when we're not so conscious, not so aware of what's happening in our minds and in our hearts. The habitual reactivity can happen when we're not mindful, when we're not present. And so beginning to explore these patterns in our daily lives begins to give us a little bit of a tool, a little bit of kind of a foot in the door towards being able to witness rather than react, being able to see a pattern and not necessarily kind of go tumbling forward into the habitual responses and reactions that we usually have in those kinds of situations. We may feel the button getting pushed, but also be able to recognize, oh, there's that button being pushed. Maybe I can not react in my habitual way. So being able to begin to look at and see in our daily lives these habits, these patterns, for me at least, this has been a huge area of growth and freedom that has happened for me in my practice. We can get a taste of, a flavor of how to work with these things in our sitting practice, and there's a lot of tools that we can cultivate in our sitting practice. In particular, we can cultivate some tools working with difficult emotions that come up. One of the key tools is seeing if we can let go of the thoughts around a difficulty and come into what's the experience, what's the actual experience of the reaction. And so that tool we can cultivate in our sitting practice, consciously letting go of thoughts of ideas, agendas around a particular reaction, the thoughts can tend to fuel a reaction, so it can take us into a spiral. And so just a simple act of recognizing, okay, this is what's happening right now. Frustration is arising. What does that feel like in the body? Can cut the cycle of thought and emotion looping. So the cutting that cycle can allow the feeling to kind of run its natural course. It's almost like you can put the gears into neutral. If you're going 60 miles an hour down the freeway, if you put your car into neutral, the car doesn't come to a stop immediately, but you're no longer giving it gas, so it will come to a stop very naturally of its own accord. And kind of similarly in our minds, when we take our put our minds into neutral, take our thoughts out of the loop. That's the thoughts are kind of like the gas on the gas pedal. We take our thoughts out of the loop. Often the feeling can simply run its course in a very natural way. It often doesn't stop immediately, much like the car doesn't stop immediately. But it does allow that emotion to just naturally release in a way. So taking an interest in these patterns in our sitting can help us to have some tools that will help us in our daily life, in our daily lives. And yet, often things are happening so much faster in our daily lives. You know, in sitting, we've got a lot more space, right? You know, what happens is happening in our minds often. You know, a memory will arise and we find ourselves reacting to that memory. So we're not like confronted with the situation right there, right directly in front of us. So we can remind ourselves, okay, this is just happening now. Maybe I can let go of the thoughts and just feel the feelings. So we can do that in sitting meditation. If we're in the midst of a conflict in daily life, we're having a conversation with somebody that's creating a charge immediately, present in the present moment, much harder to just say, oh, let me let go of the thoughts and come into my body in the present moment. I mean, very often we're called on to engage right in that moment. And often we can't just simply say, wait a minute, stop the conversation. I have to pay attention to my body right now. You know, well, that would be kind of weird, right? So there's some tools, some skills, particularly for daily life. And I started talking about some of those last week. Mindfulness is one of those tools. In daily life, though, the way we explore mindfulness with difficulty is maybe not so much about investigation as it is in our sitting practice. In our sitting practice, we may be able to explore, you know, how is this impacting the body? In fact, where is it most strongly impacted the body? And what other emotions are present? You know, we can actually take some time to investigate. In our daily lives, I think the single most helpful question that I ask myself is, what's obvious right now? You know, let's just go for the big picture. How does it feel right now? And often it's like, yuck, or bad or unpleasant. I mean, it's just kind of some really very gross or obvious kind of thing. And that's okay. Just take in the big picture. How are you in that moment? Just take that in. What's obvious right now? Using, acknowledging that to yourself with a label, a mental note, can be really powerful in daily life. Just letting yourself recognize, okay, yep, anger, yep, that's what's happening, or embarrassment, that's what's happening right now. Just acknowledging it with a label, another very simple tool, which is very helpful in sitting practice. Some of you may have explored this in sitting practice, but also in daily life, to simply acknowledge, yep, that's what's happening right now. And even using the word is happening, rather than something like, I'm angry right now. Anger's happening right now. embarrassment's happening right now. Self-judgment's happening right now. Confusion is happening right now. Confusion is happening. Just take the I out of it. Take the I'm angry, I'm confused, I'm annoyed, I'm frustrated. And just acknowledge it as this is just a state of mind that's happening right now. That simple tool is very powerful. In fact, there's even some evidence from studies on the brain and on emotions that this is a powerful tool. And the understanding is, as I understand it from what I've heard, that the use of a label like that, essentially the way emotions act in our brains is that they're kind of in the core of the brain, what's called the limbic system, the kind of the emotions are kind of generated and felt or more produced perhaps in that area of the brain. The acknowledgement with a label happens in the cortex, so it's basically evoking or bringing in a different part of the brain. So it kind of essentially does that cutting of the cycle in the limbic system. I think there's probably some feedback loops happening around the emotion that come back to a kind of fight or flight kind of pattern, very old pattern in evolution, that fight or flight kind of pattern. And so bringing in something from the higher brain, the cortex, seems to cut into that pattern a little bit. So that's the understanding of how that works from the neuroscience point of view. But in any case, it works. You know, try it. See what happens if you bring in just a light little label acknowledging what's happening for you. In our daily lives, I think one of the things that's at least for me, one of the ways I've explored or gone into this work around challenging emotions in my daily life is to, not just kind of go through my day and say, okay, I'm just going to be mindful all day long. Although that's a nice aspiration, it's also a difficult one to achieve. And so what I've seen helpful in my own experience is to actually pick some things. Pick something that you're interested in exploring. Pick something that you're interested in understanding about your mind. A pattern, a particular pattern, a particular habit that you're really interested in. And as I said, we all have our own favorite ones. So pick one that you know is happens for you, and that you it may be like happening frequently now. You may be in a situation in your life now where a particular one of these patterns is coming up a lot. Frustration or embarrassment or something. So pick something. So you've got something very concrete to anchor your mindfulness around. That, like picking a project, is kind of like picking something to say, yep, I'm going to be aware when that happens. And then setting some kind of intention about that. And you'll probably notice that you forget a lot, that you don't remember about that. It depends on what it is. I mean, if it's one of those kind of habits that has a very strong feedback loop, like anger. Anger was my first project along these lines. And I vowed to myself that I was going to be mindful whenever anger came up. And the anger was so strong in my life at that point that it did have a very strong feedback loop. It wasn't going to arise and pass without my noticing it at some point. And generally, you know, at some point I saw that I was in a rage. I was so angry that I was just sitting there frozen, just in a rage. And at some point, mindfulness kicked in, and it'd be like, oh, right, I said I'd be paying attention to this. And basically, it was like, yuck, you know, this doesn't feel good. That was about all I could take in about it. But at the same time, that very simple action of saying, I'm going to pay attention to that, just that simple noticing in that moment, the simple recognition, anger's happening right now, actually was pretty powerful. Because it, first of all, it broke the spiral. You know, it broke that spiral, that cycle of anger, and I could then start moving again. I was no longer frozen. I could, okay, I guess I go back to work now. So it had an impact, just that simple recognition, even just that simple, wow, this is unpleasant, this is hard, this is painful, and I guess I go back to work now. So sometimes it depends on what you pick. The first one I picked had a very strong feedback loop to it, and so when I made that resolve, I'm going to be aware of it. The first day, I had opportunity to look at it because I woke up in the midst of it in such a strong fashion. Other things you might pick, like impatience or embarrassment, those things may come and go during the day, and you may not consciously remember or consciously recognize, oh, embarrassment's happened, or impatience has happened. You may go through a bout of embarrassment and be caught in the embarrassment and just feeling that kind of shame, and then go on with your day and never actually have consciously acknowledged to yourself, oh, embarrassment is happening. So you may find in kind of choosing a pattern like this to resolve to be present for that, you know, you remember, like, at the end of the day, you may reflect back and think, wow, yeah, I did have that happen today, and I didn't remember. In that moment, that's not a sign of failure. That's actually, you're remembering your resolve at that point. And so in that moment, you know, just you're mindful in that moment. Just take in how you are in this moment. You don't have to, like, go back and try to reconstruct the embarrassment or your emotion. Just take in how you are in that moment. And just resolve again. I'm going to try again. I'm going to keep trying. That intention, that resolve to keep trying is very powerful. It's probably the most powerful tool in our toolkit, to have that intention to meet our experience. And I found keeping that intention fairly specific to be really helpful. So, you know, picking something in particular. And, you know, every time you may notice like 10 times over the course of a week that you've not remembered. That's okay. Just keep noticing. Keep intending. Keep that intention going. At some point, you'll be able to start connecting with that experience and noticing the pattern. So when you do start noticing these patterns, you know, when that mindfulness begins to connect with the pattern that you've chosen, the labeling, the noticing what's obvious, these are really helpful tools. Another thing that I'll say in kind of more in general is that if you pick a project like that, one thing you might start to notice, and I certainly noticed this when I did a period where I looked at impatience. I saw that impatience was big in my life, that there were a lot of periods where I was, you know, just it was around transitions often, and I just, like, was so impatient for these transitions to get over with. And so I decided, well, I'm going to look at this impatience. I'm going to watch it and observe it. And something that I began to recognize, I might have mentioned this last week, I began to see kind of the bigger impatience that would arise, and those are the ones that probably you'll come to recognize more quickly, or the first ones that you'll see are the bigger manifestations of the pattern that you've picked. And yet what I saw over the course of a few months of working with this, looking at this pattern, was just how pervasive it was. Little tiny flits of impatience in the mind. Little blips, you know, as I was opening a drawer and it stuck a little bit. Or, you know, brushing my teeth. It's like thinking, I've got better things to do than brush my teeth. Just, you know, it was all over the place. I'd be walking down the street and impatience would flare up. It's like, it was kind of mind-boggling just how pervasive the pattern was. And that actually taught me a lesson, because I began to recognize that the small ones, I think I had kind of almost pushed aside. Oh, those aren't so important, you know. It's like they're not big enough to really feel problematic. But the pattern of those small ones is so similar to the big ones. And the reactivity in the small essentially encourages that pattern to be re-cemented or re-ground, or, you know, it's just like it encourages the mind to respond in that way when we respond in that way in the small. And so the explanation neuronally for this, in my understanding, is that, you know, when the mind has a particular pattern, it's kind of like we're all familiar with ruts that the mind gets into. And it almost seems at times like, you know, there's so many avenues into particular ruts. Like for me, anger, you know, I could get to anger from just about anything. And so the pattern is reinforced in the brain the more the pattern is experienced, or the more the pattern is fired. It's like the more we experience a particular pattern, the more neurons say, yep, that must be an important one. I better shore that one up. And so the little ways that we get involved in our patterns begin to they shore up those bigger ones too. So one thing that's really, really helpful is to see that pattern in the small. The small impatience, the small irritation, the small frustration, the small feelings of loneliness, the small feelings of being not seen. Whatever it is that you're looking at, you know, just little senses of, oh, that hurt a little bit. But not so much that it feels like you know, like it's a big problem. Those are really interesting to pay attention to. Partly because the small ones don't seem to be as threatening for us. You know, they're not so overwhelming for us. You know, when we're in the big ruts, often there's so many other things coming into play that we can be overwhelmed by the emotion and by a whole bunch of other things that are coming together. It's like a whole big ball of mess. A lot of it. It's not just the basic pattern. It's not just frustration, or it's not just anger, or it's not just embarrassment. It's a whole bunch of other reactivity that's tied into it, and memories of the past and when that happened in the past. So the when it gets big, there sometimes it's harder to be present for. But when we can start to see those patterns in the small, it teaches us a lot about how that pattern works. It also begins to, at least for me, it helped me to take it a little more lightly. You know, it's like, really? Impatience when brushing my teeth? Okay. You know, it's like, I see this is a habit. I saw it more as a habit then, rather than something I was somehow doing to myself. You know, it's like, oh, I see. This is the way the mind is used to doing things. And that helped me to take it a little less personally, to see those small ways that those patterns come up. After the talk last week, somebody who had listened on the internet got a question to me about this topic, and the person expressed an interest in hearing a little bit about working with self-referential emotions. That often in daily life, I think, we do have reactivity in relationship, you know, anger or frustration or irritation or even hatred or a feeling of not being seen, a whole bunch of things in relationship. But sometimes our emotions in daily life also are in the terrain of self-negativity. You know, self-judgment, self-criticism, self-blame, shame, embarrassment, low self-esteem, feeling of unworthiness, self-hatred. And this person asked me to talk a little bit about how we might work with that in daily life. And so I'm going to add a few particular thoughts about that. Largely, the tools are the same for whatever kind of pattern is arising. The tools, I mean, the ones I've mentioned already of notice what's obvious, name it, and see when it happens in the small, those tools apply to pretty much any kind of emotion in daily life. In terms of self-negativity, there's a couple of things that I'd like to just point out. One is that it's one really helpful to distinguish between, for instance, sometimes when we do something that causes harm to somebody, or you know, we feel some kind of regret or a guilt, for instance. To begin to distinguish between a kind of, there's a wholesome side and an unwholesome side, or a skillful side and an unskillful side to some of these emotions. So having made a mistake, there is a kind of a feeling of off feeling inside when we've hurt somebody. And that off feeling, when we're not feeling like it's a problem or it's wrong or it's bad, that actually can support us, that off feeling. I mean, there's a difference between a recognition of, yeah, that wasn't a helpful thing to do. I wish I hadn't done that, or I'd like to not do that again in the future. There's a difference between that and a self-recrimination, a self-blame, a self-judgment, a self-hatred around that. So there's a distinction there, and that's an important one for us in these self-referential emotions to be clear about. Just there's a kind of a balanced recognition of, yeah, that wasn't helpful, and the kind of the mind spinning of how can one of the ways that I've seen my own mind spin around this, it's like I see something wasn't helpful, but I watch the mind try to figure out how it was okay to have done that. You know, that the mind spins trying to figure out a justification for it somehow. Well, it was really okay because this, that, or the other thing. But still, you know, the feeling when I see that happening, there's often still a feeling of like, oh, you know, no, it really wasn't a good thing to do. And so, you know, when I've actually acknowledged, yeah, that really wasn't a good thing to do, and let go of the, like, trying to self-justify, there's some way in which the heart relaxes around that. It's like, yeah, that wasn't such a good thing to do. And finding a way to make amends may not be, I mean, it depends on the situation, how whether you actually go back to a particular person and make amends, or you kind of make a resolve in your own heart, I'm going to try to not do that again. Really varies, depends on the situation. So that's an important piece around our what we might call self-judgment, that there is potentially a piece in there that is helping us to see something that wasn't such a good thing to do. Another particular exploration around some of these, in particular, things like unworthiness, self-hatred. I've seen in my own mind those patterns. You know, we experience those patterns as suffering. You know, that it's pretty clear to us we're suffering when we're experiencing self-hatred or self-judgment, self-blame. It feels like we don't want to be there. Something like self-hatred, you know, it really doesn't feel very good. And so it's clear that the heart and mind would like to not have that feeling. And so it's at least in my experience, it was, you know, yeah, that's the first way I looked at it. Was like, yeah, that's a problem. Self-hatred is a problem. Let's see if we can figure out how to work with the self-hatred, how to be with the self-hatred. So that was, you know, that was an exploration, you know, just the beginning of an exploration. I saw that self-hatred was something I got caught in over and over and over again. As I explored that pattern over and over again, watching that pattern, I began to see there were times when I was telling myself that I was doing things well, that I was good at this, that I was a good person. You know, there were times when I found that I was telling myself good things about myself. And that certainly didn't feel like suffering. In fact, it felt like that was where I was supposed to be. All of those self-hatred thoughts needed to go away and be replaced by thoughts like me telling myself, you're a good person, you can do things well. That's what in my mind I kind of thought, you know, when I started exploring this pattern. It's like, oh yeah, I see these patterns of telling myself I'm well, but that felt pretty good. You know, it's like, that didn't feel like suffering. That felt like I could feel kind of good about myself in those situations. What I began to see in exploring this pattern and seeing those thoughts, both sides, is that the thoughts of being a good person, the thoughts of doing well, the thoughts of I'm doing this right, they were a setup in my mind. It's like as I watched myself engage with those, I think what I began to see as I think back on it, it's kind of like as I saw myself say, yeah, you can do this, you're good at this, there was a subtle sense of, oh, you know, just a little bit of, I hope so, or maybe, or what if I lose it? You know, there was just a little bit of a sense of kind of having to hold on to that positive side, what I called the positive side, and that, you know, just needing to hold to that. And in watching this pattern, I saw that holding on to that, it's kind of like it was setting myself to a certain level and not giving myself permission to be anything other than that. That was the setup. Because there is no way I could come to that standard all the time. That's actually just part of being human. You know, we can't always be the best at everything. We can't always do things perfectly right. And so I began to see that holding on to, or that those thoughts were actually the beginning of the slide into the spiral of, you're no good, you can't do this, you're a failure. And so I began being very interested not only in those thoughts of you're a failure, you're no good, you can't do this. I started getting interested in the thoughts of you're good, you can do this. I started watching those thoughts also. Not to tell myself they're wrong or bad, but just to notice them. These two are just thoughts. When I started noticing that, that was a big shift in my relationship with the self-hatred thoughts. It began to even things out a little bit. As I could recognize, basically it's self-praise and self-blame. Those are the two sides there that I was playing with or exploring. When I saw, it's like, oh, self-praise, that's what's happening right now. As I saw that, it kind of took the kind of leaping onto that and trying to hold on to it. It's like, oh yes, I need to be that. I need to always be the one who can do it right. I need to always be the one who has the right answer. I need to always be the one who's successful and good. It took that kind of leaping onto that and made it much softer. And I began to see that there was a balancing out of those two sides. So that was a bit of a challenge, but I think, I mean, it's partly a challenge because there's such a belief, at least for me, there was a strong belief that what being a happy person meant was basically being that person that I was praising. You know, that was what being happy meant. And that didn't leave much room for the ebbs and flows of life. Yeah, question. If you could just wait a second for the mic to come. And while we're waiting for the mic to come, so the overall point that I wanted to make here is when you, if you see a particular self-referential pattern, if there's an opposite quality, just be kind of on the lookout for if your mind has a seesaw around those two and be aware of both sides of that pattern.
So my question was, is it cultural and is it due to sort of the duality or the bifurcated, you know, idea there's either you're good or you're bad, you know, versus being holistic?
You know, it seems fairly human to me that we have, I mean, even in the so many different cultures, so many different religions point to skillful, unskillful, good, bad. You know, I think it's pretty human to have some sense of what we often call right, wrong. You know, one interesting piece around ethics in the Buddhist understanding is that it's not so much about right and wrong, but it's more about what supports us to be happy and what takes us into struggle, into suffering. So it's much more in a practical sense. Ethics, it is very similar form in a way. I mean, the ethics around what actions to engage in, to not engage in, very similar to other religions. But the framing of it is more around, well, you know, if you engage in those actions, it's kind of very straightforward. You know, you're going to suffer if you go that way. I think our human mind tends to categorize. You know, I think that's a very natural thing. And one thing that we begin to recognize is that those categories are creations of our mind. So good, bad, success, failure. We begin to see that there's not necessarily, let's see, I don't know how I want to say this. I think in particular around these self-referential emotions, you know, shame, embarrassment, insecurity, low self-esteem, unworthiness, there are these dichotomies. You know, if there's unworthiness, there's worthiness. If there's insecurity, there's security. And those in are kind of ideas in our mind. What is security? What is insecurity? What is unworthiness? What is worthiness? So we each have created those. And a lot of that is related to culture. You know, what a culture sees as worthwhile, what a culture sees as shameful or not. You know, there's a lot of that's been embedded in us from the time that we were very young. But I think all cultures probably have their own flavors of this. You know, the particular, I think in our culture, or in the Western culture, let's say, self-hatred is apparently much more rampant than in some other cultures. There's a kind of a famous story some of you may have heard of the Dalai Lama, who I think it was at Insight Meditation Society. He was answering questions at the Insight Meditation Society a number of years ago. This is probably 20, 25 years ago. And somebody asked the Dalai Lama a question about self-hatred and feeling unworthy. And apparently the story goes that the translator translated the question to the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama and the translator had a bunch of back and forth conversation. And with which my understanding is that basically the translator had to explain to him what the person meant by feeling unworthy, by feeling self-hatred. That it was not a concept that was familiar to the Dalai Lama. His response was apparently quite striking. He turned to the person and he said, "It's not true. It's just not true that you are unworthy. It is not true. Everyone is worthy." I think some cultures have more. I mean, I think each culture probably has its own favorite self-referential emotions. You know, maybe in some cultures it's shame. In other cultures it may be self-hatred. Some of what you say about culture, I think it's very true. But I don't think there's a culture without something like this in it, just because of the way our minds are put together, and the way, you know, the Buddha was pretty amazing in terms of understanding things at a deep level of where the struggle comes from. You know, he talked at a level below culture. You know, the craving, clinging, identification, this is where our suffering arises from. And it maps out into all cultures because he was looking at the mind at such a deep level. Other questions? Other thoughts? I've got more I can explore here, but... Okay, let's see. So some more general tools, those were the kind of specifics that I thought of in terms of working with the self-referential emotions. And more generally, with any kind of struggle in daily life or any habit or pattern in daily life, one of the biggest tools that's helpful: notice when that pattern is not there. Notice when you're not embarrassed. Notice when you're not frustrated. Notice when you're not feeling angry. Notice the absence or anxiety. You know, anxiety is often one that comes up for people. You know, notice the absence of the pattern. This one is actually really powerful. I think one of the hooks that these patterns have on us is that we identify with them. We believe they happen so much to us. The ones that are familiar ones, our favorite ones, the ones that, you know, our top three habits of mind. They happen to us so much that, like, when it comes, it's like an old shoe. It's like, yeah, that's me. Yep, I'm the one that's miserable. Yep, that's me. So the very familiarity with it, we create an identification around that. And, you know, the miserable pattern, this is one for myself. I was so identified with being miserable, you know, and that identification carried through times when I wasn't miserable. So, you know, I might recognize, yeah, I'm not miserable now, but, you know, I'm happy now, but, you know, I really know what I am is miserable. That belief in the pattern being identified with me was so strong that I just almost didn't take in the times that it wasn't happening. And so consciously recognizing, yes, there is happiness now, or this pattern is not happening now, consciously taking that in begins to poke holes in the belief that it is you, because it's not there in that moment. Here you are, and it's not happening. So it begins to poke holes in the identification to take in when it's not happening. The very powerful tool, that one. Another tool I found, I'll try to just do a couple more here. Another one that I found really helpful with, particularly with patterns that are so habitual, is to begin to notice the difference between when we are caught by the pattern and when we're not caught by the pattern. So we'll often feel like we're caught by the pattern, you know, like a pattern of embarrassments coming up, and it's like we feel like we just want to disappear in the floor. We may notice embarrassment, but at the same time still feel like we're wanting to disappear. And that, you know, that, so there's like, okay, there's embarrassment and I'm caught by it. Seeing if you can acknowledge that you're caught, it takes another step back. It's acknowledging either a kind of resistance or a kind of identification with that experience. So to just recognize, oh yeah, there's embarrassment and I'm caught by it. And then beginning to notice the difference between that experience of being caught by a state and the experience of knowing, oh, embarrassment's happening. It's just something that's happening in the present moment. As you begin to notice the distinction between those two states, that's also a pretty powerful recognition. And it supports, in particular, it supports a recognition and an appreciation of the value of the practice. Because in that moment, in that recognizing of the difference of, oh, embarrassment's arising, and wow, I don't feel like I need to disappear. It just feels kind of unpleasant right now. You know, it's like, that's a big difference. And the mind begins to understand very clearly the value of that simple awareness of just meeting and knowing, oh, this is what's happening right now. That simple recognition, this is what's happening right now. Just that simple recognition is very powerful. And noticing that difference when you're caught, when you're not caught. Not to give yourself a hard time about being caught, but just knowing, oh, there's embarrassment and I'm caught by it. Actually, that simple step may help to uncatch you from the caught. You know, sometimes I've seen, I was exploring this particular practice around depression at one point. I was noticing there's depression. I was noticing the feeling of depression. And then I would notice at times it felt like a problem. You know, something has, this depression needs to go away. So I was recognizing feeling caught by the depression. So, and then I also noticed when it was gone. So I would notice it when it was absent, when it was present, when I was caught by it. And I just kind of watched that fluctuation between those states. And as I began to see the being caught state, I could see that there was an extra little belief in there that, oh, I'm caught by it, and it's a problem that I'm caught by it. And when I could just acknowledge, oh, it's depression and I'm caught. That's what's happening. It's like, it's no big deal. It's just depression, and the mind is kind of stuck in a rut about it. Okay, I can live with that. So the power of mindfulness reveals itself. The power of this practice reveals itself because that shift, it's actually a shift of insight to see, oh, it's just depression, or even it's just depression and caught. It actually doesn't take that long to begin to experience that kind of benefit if you have this kind of resolve, this interest in looking at your difficult states in daily life. I'll try to get to two quick things. One, can be really interesting to just check in when you're having a particular habit. Are there any beliefs operating? You may not see any beliefs there, but just check in. You know, okay, so I'm angry right now. And what do I believe? Well, that person's wrong. That's what I believe. Okay, just know, yep, there's a belief happening right there. Recognize that it's a belief. You don't have to tell yourself that it's false. In fact, it might be a true belief. I mean, but acknowledge to yourself, oh, this is a belief. There's a belief happening here. You can just check in. You can almost just ask yourself the question, are there any beliefs happening here? What am I believing? What am I believing right now? And you may not get an answer. I'm not encouraging a digging to try to find an answer here, but just ask the question. Sometimes when you ask the question, the belief may just like be front and center and show itself to you. At other times, it may not. So just, you know, let it go if you don't see anything. You don't have to like try to find it. Just check in. There's probably some belief there. If you're suffering, there's undoubtedly some belief happening there. And it may be so buried that you can't see it for a while. And that's okay. Just give yourself the opportunity to check in. And I need to stop, so I can't say the last one.
Oh, come on, tell us.
How many, does anybody have to leave right now? I mean, you're welcome to leave if you need to leave. Okay. The last one is just, you know, sometimes these states in our daily lives in particular are kind of overwhelming for us. And so two quick things of what to do or how to work when something is kind of overwhelming us. One is just stop focusing on it. You don't have to repress it, but just like let your attention get big. Acknowledge, recognize there's lots of other things happening right now than that thing. Sometimes when we're stuck in a habit or stuck in a pattern, it's like it takes up the whole world. It's like that's all that's happening in our mind. Consciously remind yourself there's a lot else happening here. Yeah, there's body sensations happening here. There's feeling. My feet are on the ground right now. So just widen your horizons. Let yourself recognize there's a lot else happening in the moment. And the other thing you can do is, if it's kind of really sticky, is consciously pick something else that's kind of neutral. Like, you know, feet on the ground, or, you know, butt on the chair, or sensations while you're walking. Just pick something that's kind of neutral and let your attention gravitate to that. Give yourself a break. Give yourself a break from the difficulty, because if you're overwhelmed by it, it's probably not so helpful to try to be mindful of it in that moment. It'll probably just suck you back into the rabbit hole of that state. So skillful means to step aside, set it aside. So, okay, that only took 2 minutes. Thank you.